Welcome to Renegade Naturalist Radio with Dr. Dan Bakken. Real stories and real science about nature and our changing environment. In today's episode, Dan talks about his lifelong fascination with Lewis and Clark and shares stories about writing two of his classic books about the famous explorers, Passages of Discovery and Beyond the Stony Mountains. Both books are being released as e-books for the first time this spring.
Well, I saw Passage of Discovery as a new genre. It was a guide to going where Lewis and Clark went. So it was a travel book. So I looked up, you know, how to get their driving directions, specific information. But it wasn't just a travel guide. It was a travel guide that at each site, you found out what they saw there. And then you found out what I saw as a professional ecologist about nature, a scientist. And then where they had really amazing insights, I'd talk about their ability to understand nature or their appreciation of nature or their interactions. For example, you know, I realized that most of the animals they saw, they just say, well, there was many of them. But grizzlies were pretty much always on their own. Once in a while, there'd be two. And they were so big and dangerous that they always told you how many there were. And so I realized that you could do a rough estimate of what the abundance of the grizzly bears were just from the ones that they saw, because we know where they were, the distance they traveled, and that's a standard ecological survey. It's called a line transect. So I did the standard calculations and I got a rough estimate of how many there were, and then I went to find a modern equivalent, and I was shocked to find that there was no modern equivalent. There was no modern estimate of the total number of grizzly bears, even though under the Endangered Species Act, it's legally required to recover the species to its former abundance. And nobody had a clue what the former abundance was. So, I mean, it's that kind of insight, plus understanding. Lewis understood things in a way that's amazing. There's a geological article about how he explains bubbles that occur in the Missouri River that you see. There are these big bubbles that rise up. And I didn't understand what they came from. And he figured it out, and he got it right in modern geological terms before there was anything like modern geology.
Well, you have two new books coming out in ebook just around the corner now. One that's already available, Passage of Discovery. The other one is Beyond the Stony Mountains. Both of them have Lewis and Clark as one of the centerpieces of the story. Can you tell us a little bit, first of all, before we talk about the books themselves, about your own interest in Lewis and Clark and how it came to be?
I've always loved reading about adventurers because I've wanted to be an adventurer myself. So it started off when I was in high school. I read Joseph Conrad's novels, Heart of Darkness and others, and I read Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, Wind, Sand, and Stars. And I wanted to be like them. They traveled, they sought adventure, they learned about foreign cultures, and they studied about nature and wrote about people and nature. And I loved that idea, and I wanted to do that kind of thing, only be a scientist in addition. And so then when I went into ecology and was able to travel and do this kind of thing, I was fascinated to read travel adventures by people who knew about nature. That always fascinated me. So that was just a hobby of mine. And so one of the books that I liked the best was by Peter Kalm. He was a botanist sent over by Linnaeus to collect plants from North America and to write about it. And he traveled from Philadelphia to Montreal, and he wrote these amazing descriptions about the East Coast. For example, he goes to New York City, he goes to Manhattan, and he says, this is known as a healthy place, and that the oysters are so common that the poor people live on oysters and a little bread. So, I mean, it's a really interesting picture. And so then I got interested in Lewis and Clark. They were another wonderful adventurers, and their journals were just so fascinating because of what they did, that trip from St. Louis to the mouth of the Columbia River and back, but also because they were so excellent commentators about what they saw, and they were insightful people. And so that was one of my hobbies. And so then in the mid-1980s, I was being a consultant to the National Geographic. They were doing a centennial edition with a world map that I was one of the main advisors for about the endangered earth. And then I helped them with other projects. And one of their writers came out to Santa Barbara, and we were working together. And one day we were driving back from eating dinner, and he said, you know, it'd be really wonderful if we could take one of the great explorers like Humboldt and follow where they went and write about what it's like today. And I said, you couldn't do any better than do it with Lewis and Clark. And I thought about it and thought about it, and I asked him if he wanted to do it, and he said no. So I decided to do it myself. And so I did it. And my idea was to follow Lewis and Clark and describe America before it was affected by European settlers, and then talk about it was like today. But in addition, they were so insightful to communicate their ability to understand nature from their observations, which is better in some ways than anything we do today. So that's how I got started with it.
So you were able to use the journals of Lewis and Clark to sort of capture what was happening then. How long did you plan the trip before you started off on the adventure? And did you do it all in one fell swoop, or did you come back?
No, I did this in stages. And I would do it when I could get the funding and when I had the time. So I would do bits and pieces. For example, I wanted to be able to do some of the big time stuff. And so I would like the waterborne stuff. So I would do that, but then I would have to do it in pieces. So, for example, I wanted to do the Upper Missouri River, but that was a canoe trip. So I arranged for doing the canoeing. And then I did it in several ways. Like one time I did it with a group of friends. We rented canoes from an outfitter, and we brought along the Lewis and Clark journals. And we commented on them and thought about them and wrote about them. And then when Lewis and Clark go over the mountains, the Rocky Mountains, they go over the Lolo Pass, well, they had to trade with the Indians to get horses. And so they did a horseback trip. So there was an outfitter called the Triple O Outfitting Company, and they did a ride across the Bitterroot Mountains following the Lewis and Clark Trail, going to the places that are identifiable as where Lewis and Clark went. So I did that horseback ride. And so it was step by step, you know, whenever I could. And like some of the Pacific Coast stuff, I had to do, I didn't have a lot of money to do it. So I just, you know, did it when I could fit it in. So it was done in bits and pieces.
You know, when Lewis and Clark went through that, went through there, it was pristine, it was untouched. Obviously, that's not the case today. What did you see from a natural perspective that had changed from your travels?
Well, first of all, you can't say this was untouched, because the American Indians had had a huge effect, and people have had a huge effect on landscape for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. So this wasn't untouched. It was untouched by the growing, technologically oriented, European-based civilization. But sure, the greatest example of dynamic nature is the Missouri River. It's just a wonderful case. The Missouri is always changing. Now, you know, my father was a folklorist, and so I looked up in his book some quotes he had about the Missouri River. And there was one guy who said, it's always an exciting challenge to farm on the Missouri, because you never know whether you're going to harvest corn or catfish, because it's always flooding. And then another guy said, the Missouri River, you know, is the crookedest river you'll ever see. He said, it runs crooked in the channel, and then the channel runs crooked over the land. And so the crookedness you see ain't half the crookedness there is. So it was well understood to be this really always changing, very difficult to manage river. And so then what happens is the Army Corps comes along because, you know, the steamboats started to go up the Mississippi and then the Missouri. And after the pioneers went on their own with the covered wagons. The next thing was they would travel by steamboat from St. Louis to Fort Benton, Montana, which brought them to the Rockies. Then they'd have to climb up over the Rockies. And so then trade used to go on the Missouri, but the Missouri was so unpredictable and changeable, and it had lots of sandbars and mud bars and logs in it, that the U.S. government decided it would channelize the Missouri. So it did. It straightened the Missouri River. But the Missouri River never knew that it had to be straightened, so it never would stay straightened. It's always breaking its banks. And then they put these levees in to protect the settlers on the city, on the shores, like St. Louis, from the flooding. And they would build dikes, you know, and levee, vertical levees on the side. But the more they put in levees, the more they constricted the flow, and the faster the river would run. And so the more dangerous it became. And so the Missouri would never do what the Army Corps wanted it to do. And the more levees they built, the more difficult the river became. And so you can't manage the Missouri by trying to fix it in time. I went down the Missouri River with an Army Corps of Engineer team because they managed the river by going down it every so often, and they let me ride with them. And they were really interesting guys. They were engineers who were very interested in the environment. I mean, the Army Corps of Engineers is perfectly willing to do good for the environment or not. They just want to dig dirt and move it around, and they were happy to do it, do this stuff that had to do with rechannelizing the Missouri to make it more natural. And so they drew me a diagram. This one guy, it was really interesting to talk to, drew me a diagram. He said, well, here's how we think about the Missouri. It's a plumbing system. You got six dams that they built. The three upper dams are storage. So that's where, and each one stores 1 year's average flow of water, 25 million acre feet. So that's, we store 3 years worth. Then the bottom three are valves. We can turn those on and off. So they thought of it as this static plumbing system like you'd have in your house. It didn't work that way. It would not work that way. And it was terrible for all the wildlife and vegetation. And so they had to take a different approach. You had to engineer to go along with nature's changeableness. And that's what they've done.
You relived the Lewis and Clark journey. You learned about it as both a normal person traveling the road would and a scientist. What was your biggest lessons that you took away from those journeys?
I was so interested in Lewis's reaction to the Great Falls in the Missouri River. Because here's what happened. You see, they were told to do this in, you know, basically two years. It turned out to be longer. So they set out from St. Louis, and they plan on that they're going to spend the first winter with the Mandan Indians, which is in the Midwest. And the Mandans were traders who were known, so they had some contact. And there was a map maker, and Lewis and Clark had that map. They at least knew they could go from St. Louis to where the Mandans were. So that was their first year, and they were going to overwinter. And then they were going to go from there up over the Rocky Mountains and then come down. Okay, so they leave the Mandans, and they go up the Missouri River. And the Mandans tell them how to find the right Missouri River. And they tell them to expect that there will be some falls on the Missouri, and they have to get past them. And they get to the big falls on the Missouri, and it's getting to be August. And they know they have to get across the Rocky Mountains before the snows really get going. And they leave their horses. They go up by canoe from the Mandan, so they have no horses. And they know they have to trade for horses with the Indians who live in the Bitterroot Mountains, the edge of the Rocky Mountains. And so they have a really tough time schedule. And it's because they don't get to the Great Falls on the Missouri till August. And Lewis goes ahead of Clark. Clark's with most of the men. Lewis walks ahead a couple days, and he's with a couple other guys, and he gets to the Great Falls on the Missouri, and he takes 2 days to do nothing but try to write a description of how beautiful the falls are. And he gets caught up in trying to decide which of two of the falls are the most beautiful. Now here's a very smart guy that knows he's under a tight time schedule, but he's so enthralled by the beauty of it that he can't do anything but spend 2 days trying to write a description. So, I mean, and so then you get down deep and you realize this is what human life really is about. It's modern life, trying to understand and trying to connect with nature. So it's just this marvelous experience, understanding.
So thanks very much for talking today, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.